This show is brought to you by Commercial Creative Systems, supporting the color critical, deadline driven creative services sector. Modern communications agencies depend on reliable quality print solutions because they know the costs that come with getting it wrong. From quick fix to full studio workflow calibration, Creative Systems has a solution for you. Creative Systems' market-leading experience as the creative industry's most dynamic and knowledgeable systems integration specialist delivers best-in-class copying and printing systems, MPS, proofing, and cross-media applications. And all this quality comes with the highest level of service delivered by knowledgeable and experienced personnel. And if your company is mindful of its carbon footprint and wants to reduce the environmental impact of its decisions, then Creative Systems has your back. Being part of the commercial group means that social value and sustainability are at the heart of its business, and commercial is the recipient of the Queen's Award for Enterprise Sustainable Development category. So if you need a quality service backed by years of experience working with the UK's most agile marketing and comms agencies, then check out their website at creativesystems.co.uk or call them on 0208 758 7750.
And what I realised was there's this shared sense we have that the world's changing faster now. I mean, only amplified by the current situation, that we can't quite keep up with all this baffling shift in technology and culture and everything else. Uh-huh. And yet, most of us are here living in houses that are 50, 60, in my case, 140 years old. We're still using toilets that are 400 years old. Yep. I don't know about you, but I still sleep in a bed that's been around for as long as anyone can remember.
Hello again from the Fuel Podcast, brought to you by The Advertist, the new business development platform for marketing and communications agencies. In this episode, we meet Tom Cheesewright, and he's an applied futurist. I met Tom through a mutual friend and was instantly smitten with his unique perspective on the future of various aspects of business. He's paid by big brands to help them model their future strategy to make sure they're not caught out by cultural and economic changes that are heading their way. These can be all types of companies, from FMCG brands to automotive manufacturers and everything in between. Naturally, the enforced quarantine imposed by the coronavirus meant we were all facing something new and potentially threatening to both our health and our wealth. So it was even more exciting to get Tom's perspective on how we can all learn to adapt and thrive in these most extraordinary of circumstances. In this show, we discuss Tom's new book called High Frequency Change, his views on van drivers, selfishness, machines talking to machines, and the future of cold calling and selling. So let's jump into the wormhole and meet Tom Cheesewright, applied futurist. Now, I'm wondering how much I can milk this joke, but welcome again to the new episode of Interesting People Trapped in Their Homes with your host, Keith Smith, and this week, applied futurist Tom Cheesewright. It's good to talk to you, Tom. I would say that you sit in the outer orbit of my connection, so many thanks for carving time out of your schedule. firstly, everyone doing okay in your world?
Yeah, all good. We're well isolated. Some distinct risk factors in this house with various asthmatics, so we've been extremely cautious.
Good. Well, I read a lot of the content that you put out, but I kind of rarely contribute to any of the discussions because I feel a bit sometimes like I've turned up to a gunfight with a banana. But before we kick off on this intellectual odyssey, perhaps you could just explain to me and to the listeners what exactly an applied futurist does.
So I work with people and organizations, both public and private sector, around the world, to really help them answer three questions. And the first one is, what does our future look like? And that's not crystal balls or tea leaves. That's some fairly rudimentary business processes that says, what are the big trends that are going to affect us in the next few years? What are the pressures that we're facing already? Mm-hmm. Where do those two things collide? And what problems are they going to cause us? Or for that matter, opportunities. And I do that for all sorts of organizations like BMW and Audi and Barclays and HSBC and even HMRC, ever popular.
Wow.
And then once we've done that piece of foresight, we've got to then translate it into a story, because there's no use having a vision of the future if you can't compel people to act on it. So I do a lot of storytelling with people, going and talking to boards and shareholders or staff or customers about this vision of the future and what it looks like and what it means for them as well.
Okay.
And then finally, the really thorny bit of the whole process is the reason I'm an applied futurist, not just a science fiction writer, is I get involved in the solutions as well. You know, what do we do about it? Once we've seen this vision of the future, what does the answer look like? And so I get involved a lot in organizational change and how do you make organizations more agile?
Wow. Okay. And I mean, how on earth did you get into it?
I mean, yeah, it's a matter of choice. It's a made up job, so you have to choose to make it up. I guess there's two answers.
At school, when they said when they had the careers person there, it's like, well, I already know what I'm going to do.
Yeah, there was not that. I was absolutely clueless what I wanted to do until well into my 20s, really.
Right.
But age two, my mum bought me the Usborne Book of the Future, and I can reach out and touch it here on my shelves right
now.
Wow.
Okay.
Which was a real. It was a book of futurism. You know, it was about the year 2000 and beyond. And I love that book. I've always loved that book. I still love that book, and that kind of set me on this path, I guess.
Okay.
And then about 8 years ago, I jumped ship from my last startup again. I say jumped. I took an assisted jump. I had the hands of the investors firmly in my back at the same time.
Okay, good.
And yeah, it was a question of what I was going to do. And I was being asked to do some consulting, which was sort of futurist-ish.
Right.
I was already broadcasting for the BBC, doing a few things a week on 5 Live and Radio Manchester and various other places. And I was being asked to do a lot of public speaking as well. And I smashed it all together and went and sat down with a friend of mine who's a brilliant branding guy. Hello, Stuart. And bought him some beers. And while I was at the bar, he came up with this phrase, applied futurist.
That's fantastic.
And that was kind of it. And yeah, I guess it took me about 2 years after deciding I was an applied futurist to really work out what it was.
Right.
And professionalize it. And so I had to build my own toolkit, which I now teach and license. I got the customers actually came relatively quickly, surprisingly, and some big customers as well. You know, first 6 weeks I had LG, Nikon and Sony Pictures ring up saying, "Who? We need a futurist." and it's great. And I turned around to them and said, "That's great. What does a futurist do? And I'll do it for you."
Fantastic.
But since then, it's become a lot more professional.
Well, I mean, you know, so you've pretty much carved out a niche for yourself, really. I mean, you sort of created the whole thing for, you know, out of nothing, which is, you know, a fair play to you for that.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of futurists and futurologists and trend forecasters out there, and we all sort of, you know, carve slightly different paths. But yeah, you know, and we're all, you know, we all do slightly different things. There's some very academic ones who do a lot of stuff with government and spend, you know, 2 years doing a deep dive on one thing, about, you know, what might happen in 25 years. You know, my beat's much more tends to be, you know, quick engagements with how do we avoid being the next Nokia or Blockbuster.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot of my beat. And then also some of the really fun stuff as well, like, you know, done projects on the last year on the future of the car with Auto Trader, which was great. And the future of sport with Grosvenor Casinos, which was great. And the future of pizza as well, which caught a lot of people's attention.
Now that would catch my attention. The future of pizza, that's fantastic. Is it still round?
It is still round. It's
Thank
the
God
base
that.
That upsets okay. some people. I'm still getting abuse on Instagram from Italy for including ground up insects in the base.
Oh, okay. So we're featuring on the dough side of things, I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's interesting you sort of listening to you talk about that, because I was talking to somebody working for a large house builder the other day, and they were obviously talking about the effects of the coronavirus and having to completely shift everything, and, you know, and suddenly they were into panic stations and stuff. And they told me that, you know, a couple of years ago, they'd actually run some kind of risk scenarios on the business, you know, and it covered anything from kind of directors, you know, being involved in an airplane crash or, you know, flood, you know, whatever it happened to be. But the one thing they didn't factor into was just a big viral outbreak of anything. And so it sent them scrambling again. So, you know, has anybody ever asked you to model for this sort of thing?
Do you know, not for a pandemic. No, I mean, the only people I know who were actually modeling something of this scale was the World Health Organization.
Right.
They had this program, and it was still in its early phases, but they were looking at this thing called Disease X. Before right. they had a name for it, which they knew was probably going to come at some point. They were expecting it to be a SARS-like disease that, again, transferred from animals to human beings. But, you know, they weren't, they even, you know, they were, even the World Health Organization wasn't quite prepared for this. The interesting thing, though, is when you do those risk scenarios, what tends to drop out of them, whatever the risk is quite a lot of the same measures. So, you know, even if you were modeling for total power failure or, you know, strikes or, you know, collapse of the supply chain, you know, you tend to end up modeling quite similar responses. I mean, not all the same, obviously, but, you know, there's quite often a similar group of things. And what I found is, although, you know, I never said to any of my clients, because no one ever asked me to, you know, what the possibility of a pandemic was, I look at the advice that I've been giving them in terms of how you respond and the flexibility and the agility. Yeah. And actually, most of the advice I've given them against different threats is very, very similar to what I might have given in this scenario.
Okay. So there are some common threads to everything, basically. And yeah. You know, yeah, no, I get it. Well, that's probably the biggest preamble that I think I've ever done. It's fascinating talking to you. But so, I mean, I wanted to kind of try and sort of dive into to where we were going. And you put out, you recently sort of launched your new book, High Frequency Change. And so, how's the book promotion going? I mean, obviously, given social distancing rules, I'm guessing that the book reading tours are a little bit kind of changed now. tell us all about it. What's the story behind the book?
So the book is me trying to explain why those big companies started calling me and still call me in many ways. It's like, you know, this absolute bafflement I had that I've just set up this business and these big businesses are ringing me. It's like, why? Like, why are these people that I think, you know, must be so far ahead in their thinking of everybody else, why are they calling me for help? And what I realized was there's this shared sense we have that the world's changing faster now. I mean, only amplified by the current situation, that we can't quite keep up with all this baffling shift in technology and culture and everything else. Uh-huh. And yet, you know, and yet most of us are here living in houses that are 50, 60, in my case, 140 years old. You know, we're still using toilets that are 400 years old.
Yep.
You know, I don't know about you, but I still sleep in a bed that's been around for, you know, as long as anyone can remember. Lots of stuff really isn't
fantastic. You mean, obviously the bed design rather than the actual bed itself been around for so long?
Yeah, well, I did actually once try to sleep on a bed that I'm pretty sure came straight out of the 1800s. And with my respiratory condition, woke up in the middle of the night, barely able to breathe. But, yeah, we'll be trying that again. But, you know, and so it was an attempt to explain that, like why you get these sort of these very yeah. fast moving waves of change that are utterly disruptive to some industries. You know, like, you know, I mentioned Blockbuster, but the whole of the media industry has been utterly disrupted.
Yep.
It's happening with banking now. It's arguably happening with politics at the moment. You know, well, meanwhile, lots of stuff just isn't changing very fast at all. And it was my attempt to explain those two things and actually start to explain, you know, what you do about it. And then, you yeah. know, it's been received really well. You know, I was delighted to be nominated for and actually shortlisted for the Business Book Awards this year. I didn't win it, sadly, but you know, great to be in that sort of
just to be in the running is good.
Yeah, and the guy who won it was the CEO of Havas with okay. his book No Bullshit Leadership. So you know, it was a really good company to be in, and yeah, it's been very well received, and yeah. I've just submitted my next book, which will be coming out later this year. Exactly when to be determined for obvious reasons.
Yes, I was going to say, yeah, probably worth pumping the brakes slightly on that one until we see what's going on. But
or maybe bringing it forward for digital versions. We shall see.
There you go. Yeah, and there's a lot of I mean, it's down to how you adapt to these things. And I guess that you know,
if everybody's sitting at their house, sitting in their home, then, you know, it'd be great to, now that Waterstones has finally decided to close its stores, I think it would be one of those things that you could possibly deliver on a digital basis. So,
given the number of books in our house, I'm pretty sure my wife thought Waterstones was an essential Richard Stone.
Fantastic. But you put out, I think it was today, I'm not quite sure, I forgot to check, but it's a good little article on the selfish gene, which you called the Self-Preservation Society. So firstly, props for the title. Great title. Riffing on my one of my favourite films, The Italian Job. And fun fact, Michael Caine was from where I was born in Bermondsey, and my dad was a sort of a dead ringer for him in the Alfie days. So, anything Italian Job, I immediately respond to. But in the article, you kind of humorously kind of kick off talking about a potentially selfish delivery driver in a van. And I recently had a discussion about how the logistics industry is one of the few that's kind of experienced a real kind of upturn in business, which I'm sure we can thank Amazon for, and then the coronavirus. But is this the new normal? I mean, do you think we're kind of destined to have everything delivered to our doors?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, okay, the delivery driver is on a sort of short lifespan, frankly. You know, the technology to replace them is there. And actually, particularly in this environment, you know, right now,
Talking about driverless stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
You know, a human being handling stuff at each end, a very expensive human being. When actually, you know, right now, with everything that's going on and social distancing, I'd much rather have a sanitized robot rock up with it outside my door and send me a text message to go and pick it up. And that's kind of what's coming. You know, we're experimenting with these rolling drones right now.
Yeah.
We've got to be able to scale up logistics for that, both in terms of speed of delivery and, but more importantly, the efficiency. You know, there's enormous amounts of particulate pollution comes out of those diesel-powered delivery vans.
Yeah.
They are shifting to electric. But, you know, but even better than that would be smaller units that don't use the roads but use the pavements. Mm-hmm. Ultimately fly, but that's a little way further off in cities. They're just not safe enough or quiet enough yet. But, yeah, you know, at some point in the future, absolutely. Because we're basically lazy. Like one of the, you know, the underlying motivations I think you have to understand about human beings is we're basically lazy. I mean, you look at, you know, one of the stories I tell a lot is that, you know, you go back 3.5 million years, and before even humans were human, we were already making tools to make our lives easier. realizing it was a bit less effort to butcher whatever animal we caught, that
right,
woolly mammoth caught, if we used some sharpened stones rather than trying to pull them apart with our hands, you know? And so this fundamental human instinct to sort of take friction out of our lives is a really important driver. And so, we enjoy shopping, but we'd much rather have the stuff dropped to our home, which is why everyone walks around the shops with Amazon on their phones and doing price matching.
That's incredible, isn't it? Because it's like, it was only like, 10, 15 years ago when people were just imagining, you know, being able to do things like that. And, you know, certainly I was kind of, that's never going to happen. You know, people are still going to go and want to go and touch and feel these things. And, I mean, this was back in the day. I was working at a dot-com startup, a search engine, and we ended up buying some of the technology from the company Boo when it finally went bust. And
I remember that.
Yeah. And that was incredible because, you know, we were kind of like, well, see, told you that was never going to happen, you know. And but it was just ahead of its time. That was the problem with it. And
you highlight a really interesting thing about futurism, which is actually quite often seeing what's going to happen is quite easy. If you take those basic sort of human drivers I talked about, and some basic economic drivers, and you map the two against each other, some fairly obvious stuff drops out. What's really hard is predicting when it's going to happen.
Yes.
And so you saw that with Boo. You saw that with a company I used to work with, a company called Exodus, who were the largest web hosting company in the world in 2000. And, you know, 2 years later, I was explaining to the British media what Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection meant and how they weren't really bankrupt. They'd just taken a voluntary action to avoid being bankrupt. And they went from being worth, I don't know, $4 billion or something to being sold to Cable and Wireless for about $80 million.
Wow. That's just crazy, isn't it? Absolutely yeah. crazy. But so
they're the right business, just too early.
Yeah, and often the case. And I'm sure all the people behind Boo are sitting there going, "See, I knew I was right. I was just got the timing slightly wrong." But you know, it's certainly soaked up a lot of money. That's for sure. But
they had some good parties.
Yes, I'm sure they did, and I think they had. I think there was some private jets involved, but I think. But I know their servers were pretty spectacular when we got hold of those. They were that was quite a without sounding crude, it was quite a rack. But it was very good. But anyway, back onto your article about the selfish gene. You talk about, you know, the art of self-preservation and stuff, but and kind of that's always thought of as kind of the ultimate in self-preservation, being selfish. But I mean, in this climate now, do you think there's a kind of a good business case for being unselfish these days?
I think there's long been a good business case of being unselfish. And actually, you know, I see this a lot in my clients, and maybe they're self-selecting by the ones who actually call me. But I see quite different motivations from a lot of leaders I work with. You know, you used to come in as a CEO, and you knew your tenure was going to be about 5 years. You know, the average right. tenure for a CEO in the UK or the US is about 5 years. And you'd come in and you go, right, I've got 5 years. I'm going to save a bit of cash here. I'm going to bump up some growth there. I'm going to, you know, jump out with my golden parachute just when the share prices are at a high after 5 years. And now they're coming in and they're looking at the market. They're looking at all the volatility and they're going, do you know what? I've got really low confidence that I can do that. Right. Even if I execute perfectly, the chances of me getting through the next 5 years without some major disaster like taking me out at the knees are really small. So they're changing the narrative a bit. They're going back to shareholders and saying, do you know what? I'm not the person who's going to deliver you, you know,
quick fix,
stellar growth, you know, year on year for the next 5 years.
Yeah.
I'm going to set out to deliver sustainable success. And I'm going to start to put all the pieces in place to ensure that this business has got a long and happy future and that your long-term investment is safe. And so they're changing the narrative and saying, and when they, as soon as they start to do that, as soon as they lift their eyes to the further horizon, they're saying, well, we've got to make sure that we've got no ethical violations and that our customers love us still in 10 years' time. So we can't have another, payment protection scandal like we've had in the banking industry.
Yep.
We can't have another tobacco industry, you know, hiding the impact of smoking scandal. You know, we've got to be really transparent. We've got to look after our staff as well. You know, and as soon as they start looking to the future, they realise that actually their staff, they can't recruit the people they need because those people don't exist in the market.
Right.
You know, either nobody's got the skills that they want, or there just aren't enough people with the skills that they need, whether they're digital or communication or design or whatever. So they're saying, actually, we have to invest in our people a lot more. And so, you know, I think this much more unselfish behaviour, particularly from large corporations, is coming about through really good business sense. But it's still a very difficult narrative. It's a very difficult conversation for a new CEO to have with shareholders.
And it's still, I think, it's a very nascent skill as well. I mean, I think that people have got to have to do quite a bit of learning in order to, you know, for that to trickle down, you know, into the sort of the SME market and stuff like that.
Yeah. Well, it's also. It's part of a much bigger behaviour change from leaders, which I'm just writing about this at the moment for a column for a magazine. About, you know, we think, when you think, if I say the word leader to you, Keith, you know, yeah. What pops into your head?
Well, a leader to me is, you know, somebody that people kind of rally round, and somebody that stands in the middle of a crowd at a slightly higher level with his arm up in the air and a sword attached to it. You know, it's kind right. of you know.
So you've done exactly the same things as me. You've gone down immediately sort of military leader.
Yeah.
You know, you're sort of strong man typically. We do typically think of men, I think, when you talk about leaders still, because, you know, sadly, overwhelmingly, you know, I read a stat this morning, there's a book.
Oh, man, I should have said a woman, shouldn't I, really?
No, but you're right, you know, there's a book, I think it's called Create a Gender Balanced Workplace. It's in the same series that my next book's coming out in, and Penguin Business. And there's a stat in there that says, you know, less than 10% of executive directors around the world are women yet. Less than 10%. And so we still think of men. We think of what Polly Labar, who wrote Mavericks at Work, book called The White Man Pointing Right. You know, because you imagine those, you know, the front covers of the sort of the 90s and noughties business magazines. It's always that guy in the double-breasted power suit, you know, pointing towards the future. And this is what we think of when we think of a leader. We think of somebody who knows the answer, who drives the direction, when actually, you know, leaders are increasingly having to go into work and go, do you know what, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know the answer. And this is one of Polly's points is, you know, you've got to go into work and ask questions. You've got to go into work and collaborate. You've got to go into work and learn every day.
Well, you see, that's fascinating because, I there's no way I would ever class myself as a leader. And I mean, in my business, I mean, you know, I consider myself to be the sort of the dumbest in the company. And, but you know, the point is that, you know, I love to learn. So, you know, and I tend to surround myself with people that know more than me. So, you know, it's kind of that's the only way that I can find to lead because I'm, you know, I'm not really inspirational, but, you know, I can pull people together. But, you know, to me, a leader still is somebody that pulls from the front. I mean, whether it's a man or a woman, but, you know, I mean, two ones that spring to mind, obviously, you have the Richard Bransons of this world, who I think very charismatic leaders. You've got Catherine Corrich as well, who I also think at SysDoc, who I think is a fantastic female leader. And these are people that put themselves out there and sort of create inspiration around them. And I think that's a lot of the role. But
I don't know Catherine, but I think you're right. Yeah, what Branson's famous for is surrounding himself with people who are smarter than he is. You know, he's got that inspirational leadership. He creates that environment, that platform where people clearly want to work for him. But then he says, do you know what? You know better than me how to execute on this and trust them to deliver it.
Yeah.
And I think that's you know, it's an interesting model. He may not be the best model in other ways, but I think he's a really interesting model for that combination of inspiration and collaboration.
It's like I'll supply the venue, you supply the party. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Yeah. So back in December, I ask you to look back, not forwards. Now, I emailed you and contacted you on the off chance you could help me put an article together about the future of sales and new business. And it was a real kind of Hail Mary of a request right in the middle of the last minute Christmas rush. And you wrote back and you were just like, well, what's the deadline? And I realized that you were right in the middle of finishing your book. And I kind of thought no more about it and kind of wrote the piece myself. And only to find that right on the deadline, you came up with the goods. So firstly, I mean, thanks very much for being such a great fella. I mean, I wasn't expecting it. And, the word dependable doesn't even begin to cover it. But I appreciate that. But secondly, I told you at the time that I thought it was so good that I wanted to kind of save it for later. So if it's okay with you, could we just dive into that for a second? Because there was a couple of interesting points in there that I wanted to cover.
Yeah.
I mean, you brought up a great point about the dawn of the machine-to-machine age and how that influences marketing and sales, etc. I mean, in your opinion, I mean, what role does a brand or will a brand have when machines are kind of doing all the buying? I mean, are you really kind of envisaging such a kind of dystopian future that, you know, and if not, how do you think that branding is going to be affected by the M2M age?
So here's what I imagine, right? So fast forward 10 years, most of us have swapped our phones for smart glasses. And those smart glasses have cameras in, high-definition cameras, and they have a variety of sensors that monitor your body. So they know when you're sweating, they know when your heart rate's elevated, they know what your breathing pattern's like, they know what your pupil dilation's like and what you're looking at. And they can combine all those things to say, do you know what? Keith likes this or Keith doesn't like this. Now, you put that in a world where we're surrounded by more choice than we ever have been. Just trying to pick what to watch on Netflix or Disney Plus or Amazon Prime right now.
That's a whole evening in itself, isn't it?
Right, exactly. It's an enormous cognitive challenge just in its own. So you've got this incredible surfeit of choice combined with a machine that can understand what you love and what you don't, combined with artificial intelligence that can process all that information, as well as everything that your friends and family like, all the recommendations you get, and basically spit out answers. And you go, why would I bother investing all this cognitive effort in making decisions about when I could just have the things that the machine knows I like? Now, that might be really bog standard. And, you know, bog standards are a good example. Like, who cares about shopping for the toilet roll, right? Yep. Like, right now, everyone. But, you know, until the coronavirus issue and, you know, the shortages, no one ever thought very hard about shopping for toilet roll, right? No. It's just, you need it. You don't want to run out. And as long as it's, you know, it's the soft stuff and not that sort of scratchy stuff you used to get at school, it kind of happens.
The skinny stuff.
So, right, you know, so why would I ever want to, you know, expend my precious, you know, clock cycles of my brain thinking about toilet roll when I could outsource that to a machine that just makes sure that I never run out? Because right. Every time I walk into the bathroom in my smart glasses, it looks at the pile of toilet rolls and goes, that's running down, I'll order some more. And, you know, it's true of tins of tomatoes. It's true for people like me who are fairly lazy about what they wear for clothes. Do you know what? I'm on my fifth, sixth pairs of the same jeans. Like, you know, Tom's running out. Best contact Levi's, get another pair.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Because we know what he wears. And so, you know, a lot of this stuff is just going to be automatic. And it's particularly in the categories where the most marketing money's been spent. Honestly, do I care what washing liquid I use? Do I care what brand of cornflakes, as long as they taste good? Sorry, Kellogg's client. You know, it's, and so, you know, all of those things could be outsourced. What brand does in that environment is takes your sale out of the machine to machine loop. It says this human being cares about what interacting with this brand says about them.
Right.
And they care enough to take the time to make this purchase.
So it would learn that you like that brand. It would learn that you like that particular brand of, let's say, toilet paper.
For certain items that you care about, and that, you know, it may be toilet roll, right? You know, I'm sure you could do a good enough branding job on toilet roll to take it out of that automated loop. You make those purchases manually. You interact with the brand directly. You take that decision away from the machine. You could just, you know, basically weight the decision making of your machine to stick to the brands you like, or you just take it out of the machine's hands entirely for those brands you care about.
Yeah, or kind of artificial intelligence as well. I mean, after a sort of a process, after a repeated process and stuff like that, it would learn that this is the particular brand that you like, and this is, you know, the frequency that you like it, and that's it. You know, I mean, I'm kind of hoping that it's going to go down that route. You know, that it's not going to take the decision completely out of my hand.
But also, that loyalty could be very rapidly disrupted. So, you know, use the example of breakfast. Cereal.
Yep.
I can, you know, as you can imagine, I spend a lot of time in hotels.
Yep.
I come down for breakfast one morning, I've got my smart glasses on, and, you know, I pour myself some cereal from whatever hotel I'm in, and my glasses go, oh, do you know what? Tom likes this. In fact, we're getting a better reaction from this than the normal stuff he has at home. Let's look up its health values. Yeah, do you know what? Nutritionally, it's only marginally worse for him than his normal brand flakes. And, you know, price-wise, it's within the bounds that he will accept. Given the margin of happiness over his normal brand, we will swap his brand out for this.
Oh, man.
And, you know, I think that, you know, that creates a lot of fluidity in choice. And, you know, and that's in something that I do reasonably care about. Do you know what? I like my breakfast cereal. You know, right. Things like bank accounts or insurance or stuff that, you know, who provides your energy? Like, you know, how do you have a brand association with an energy company when, you know, when your AI can jump you to the best tariff every 15 minutes?
Yeah.
That's potentially challenging.
That's true. I mean, it's always mystified me as to why the banks tend to sponsor, you know, sort of football teams and energy companies get involved, because really it's just like you'd swap them in a heartbeat if you could, if there was a better offer came through. But still, they, you know, that's that's just my buying choices. Now, you also said in the article that the future of what we now understand to be the sales process of cold calling looks a little bleak, because even now, I mean, we've got people shielding themselves behind sort of digital personal assistants and all that sort of thing, and it doesn't look like it's going to change very much. But you said that, and I think it's very key, that relationships are going to play an even greater part in the sales process. And there's an old adage that I always fell back on and still do, that the buyer buys the seller and not the salt. And perhaps, you know, this might never be so true as in the future. I mean, how do you think that sales are going to be conducted when buyers are so protected?
So, I mean, the underlying point behind this is that the more things are digital and automatic and ephemeral, the more we care about the visceral and the human and the you know, face-to-face, albeit with, you know, 2 meters between us right now. And it's, I don't see that changing. It seems to be a fundamental trend that's played out across, you know, every industry that's been digitized so far. And music's a really good example. Mm. You know, that music now, we used to, you know, pull out a vinyl record, put it on the record deck, and it was, you know, it was an activity in itself, listening. Mm. Whereas now, you know, we shout at our, you know, smart speaker across the room and it just plays as a randomly assorted playlist. But, you know, while that's happened, while 80% of our consumption might be digital and ephemeral like that, we spend way more on going to concerts and gigs and interacting, yes, with those artists and, right, you know, sure enough, on vinyl. So, you know, translate that into the sales world, you know, 80% of the stuff we do might be digital. Mm-hmm. 80% of the sales, maybe even the first, you know, few pieces of the funnel might be entirely automated. But when we get down that funnel, you know, particularly for high value or high trust situations, it's going to come down to the human being. Because actually, you know, the other thing that technology does is it makes it easier and easier for lots of people to hit the same level of service. You know, it's, how do you differentiate between banks these days? You know, mm, when you know, fundamentally they look the same. How do you differentiate between electricity providers when then, you know, fundamentally you're getting exactly the same electricity at the end? You know, and actually the same is true of a lot of service industries now as well. You know, it's how do you differentiate between two different designers on Fiverr? You know, it's you know, you're getting fundamentally the same level of service, perhaps, you know, right, slight, you know, with slight tweaks. And the only thing that differentiates between them is the relationship, the personality,
yes,
you know, how the human being at the other end treats you. And so, you know, it affects all sorts of different aspects of business, definitely sales. You know, I think actually things like professional services are going to be really interesting in the next few years, where, you know, it's pretty much impossible to differentiate between two law firms on the quality of the work that they do, because they're both going to be using basically the same AI-driven tools to write the contracts and do everything else. You're going to really differentiate on the some level of creativity, but also the, you know, the human relationship and the arm around the shoulder and the trust, the sense of trust that they give you.
That's fantastic. This is getting so. I mean, basically, we're kind of back to the old sort of methods, really, of cultivating relationships and stuff through something like a shared experience or an emotion or something at a kind of deeper level, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, there's going to be a big role for people who can play both the digital interaction and the physical interaction, who can create a sort of coherent and consistent personality and personal brand across those two that allows them to reach a lot of people, build a relationship with all those people. I mean, it's salesperson as influencer. You know, it's I was having a conversation with someone yesterday about the word influencer and what it means these days. But yeah, it has a long history for me because my old boss, Nick Hayes, actually wrote the book Influencer Marketing back in about 2002. And so in my early career, I worked on about four or five of the first real, you know, defined methodology, empirically driven influencer marketing campaigns.
Wow.
And I think, you know, that salesperson as influencer is going to be really interesting.
I see definitely that the relationship side of it's going to play up a lot more, you know, as the sort of delivery side of it tends to sort of flatten out. The relationship side of it's going to play a lot more. But Tom, this is getting very, very meaty and deep, but in this podcasting age, I have to keep the lights on, and that means letting our sponsors throw some elbows. So if you're cool with it, we'll be right back after this after this commercial break.
This show is made possible by the participation of Commercial Creative Systems, the first choice for London's creative community. Those that know the world of imaging are raving about the Canon ImagePress C710. Rather than viewing a copier as something to run prints from, Creative Systems sees it as a way to make you stand out from the crowd. This isn't only the highest quality professional laser device available, but it also has some fantastic capabilities, such as consistently accurate color, print on and automatically duplex up to 350 GSM card, media flexibility, whether that's snakeskin, pearl effect or 1.3 meter banners, this device really does it all. And, oh no, if disaster strikes during a deadline-driven pitch, your machine will be fully calibrated, repaired, and up and running within 2 hours, 24/7, courtesy of your dedicated Creative Systems engineer.
And we're back. We're back with Tom Cheesewright, Applied Futurist, and we're doing a little crystal ball gazing. Oh, man, I bet you are sick of that term, though, aren't you? Crystal ball
gazing. Well, at least you didn't say, the one I hate most is, they'll say something, say, bet you didn't see that coming.
Ah, oh, yeah, well, I better scrub that one off then. I mean, we're talking about how the new business industry is going to sort of change over the next couple of decades. Now, I'm going to throw a name at you, and I'm a big fan and a recent convert, I got to say, of Alvin Toffler's 1970s book Future Shock. I picked it up purely out of just out of boredom, really, and started reading it about a year ago. But it's fascinating, and I keep going back to it, which is very rare for me with a book because I tend to very much live in the moment as for everything. But the book is fascinating because given what we're going through right now with the coronavirus epidemic, the relevance of Future Shock comes into sharp focus because the title itself, Future Shock, applies to the condition that people feel when too many changes happen in too many areas at once. So you've got, your work, your life, your family, etc. And if things are going wrong in all of those at the same time, we all feel a little overwhelmed. And that's the term Future Shock. Now, you proposed the term culture shift about the new working paradigm. I mean, can you just explain briefly what you mean by people having to adapt to a new culture shift? I mean, making things happen, etc.
Sure. Well, I will first say Alvin and Heidi Toffler, Future Shock, was by.
Well, that's right. Yes, true.
What I mean by that is working from home adds absolutely no value, does nobody any good whatsoever if we basically try to recreate the office in the house. And, okay. I've been getting really frustrated by lots of the advice I've seen people sharing on social media and in lots of articles and, radio broadcasts recently about how to work from home effectively. And it's, all this stuff like, make sure you get up in the morning and put some smart clothes on and, find a place to work and get yourself set up like it's your desk. And, and all this stuff. It's like, why would we try and recreate the famously unproductive office environment? It's like, no, don't, right? Here's what you should do if you're working from home. First of all, work out what is your natural rhythm in terms of sleep and wakefulness. When are you at your best during the day? Are you, as Daniel Pink calls it, you an owl or a lark? Are you an early morning person? You best late at night? And start with that and then work to it, right? Work when you are at your best. Work in bursts if that's what works for you. Work in long stretches if that's what works for you. You get up and go for a walk if that works for you. Have coffee if that works for you. Have biscuits if that works for you. Just do the things that allow you to work in the happiest and most productive way possible that take advantage of your unique individual physiology, character, behavior, and everything else. Like trying to mold yourself into some sort of, office robot when you're at home is just pointless. It took me a long time to work this out. I've been working for myself for 15 years, and it's really only in the last five that I've forgiven myself my sort of Protestant work ethic and, accepted that, if I want to have a nap at 11 o'clock in the morning, I can have a nap at 11 o'clock in the morning. If I want to stop
nothing wrong with naps.
Right, exactly. Yeah, if I want to stop work after lunch and do something completely different, because rather than sit in front of the computer and beat myself up for not getting anything done,
right,
then you know what? That's what I should do. And yet, you know, all of the advice we're seeing about home working is completely opposite to that. It is basically recreate the office at home, the famously unproductive office. And so what I mean by a culture shift is when we're telling people to work from home, it's not about the technology. It's not about the video calling. It's not about the VPNs and the cloud systems. Mm. You know, it's not about trying to replicate the office in a different location. It's saying, what do we care about? We care about people doing great work. Right. So what are the parameters for this individual to do great work in a way that delivers against, you know, their objectives and the betterment of the business? Right. And start from those first principles and reinvent everything else.
That's fascinating, because obviously, I mean, you know, I mean, you referenced the sort of military mentality a while back. And I mean, that's very much the kind of where the modern office sort of culture tends to come from, is, you know, people in boxes doing set things at set times. It's very relevant now. That's fascinating, because obviously, you know, bringing up the idea or looking at things like the gig economy, and the way that obviously you live your life and I tend to live my work life as well, which is kind of lots of different activities to make one busy day. So it's like, you know, a couple of hours here doing this, two on that, and, you know, in and out of the place, in and out of the office, backwards and forwards, and doing different things, because that's what I think that's what makes people more productive, is the fact that they can actually sort of shift gears and start to and do something different, like, you know, go and whittle on a piece of wood for an hour or something, if that's what takes your mind away.
Absolutely. You know, more and more of our work is cognitive, not physical. You know, we require more and more thought and less physical action, which is why all of us need to go to the gym or, you know, mm-hmm. join in with Joe Wick's 9 a.m. PE sessions at the moment. and so, you know, if that's the case, you know, why are we still shaping work around the history of work, which used to be physical?
Yes.
Can you pick and place parts on a production line for 8 hours a day, 9 to 5, sure. Can you write for 8 hours a day? Can you, you know, deliver presentations for 8 hours a day? You know, can you do any of these things consistently at a level of quality and, you know, for 8 hours a day? You absolutely cannot, unless you are some sort of freakish genius.
Yeah.
And, you know, most of us aren't. So why do we try and... I just don't understand it. And it's... Like I say, it took me a long time to forgive myself for leaving it behind. But once you do it, it changes your world.
But when you... Okay, so when you're talking to, you know, sort of big brands and stuff like that, and they call you in and let's say you paint this picture for them, are you getting kind of, you know, an eyebrow raised whenever you start to, you know, start to mention it? Because, you know, that's... I mean, are they acceptable? Are they accepting that kind of vision of the future?
Yeah, totally. Totally. I mean, for all sorts of good reasons. I mean, you know, think about employment. You know, lots and lots of companies are really struggling to find enough good people,
right,
particularly, you know, digital skills, those sorts of skills. And so they're doing anything they can to get those people in. So I did a talk recently with one group about this idea of suburban capitals, where actually big companies are moving out of the city of London, out to places like Croydon, because the only way they can attract the high quality staff that they want is by creating a lifestyle for them that they simply cannot afford in central London. So they're moving their headquarters out so that people can buy homes and their kids can go to, you know, schools in walking distance, not on three buses and a tube, you know, and all these things.
The campus.
And you then put that in the context of changing working patterns and say, do you know what? So much of this stuff is easier if you work flexibly. If not everyone is trying to jump onto the same bus at the same time in the morning,
mm-hmm.
you know, if the people who work for you could be just as easily be in, you know, in Cumbria as in Croydon,
yeah,
and, you know, be in the office, you know, once a week, and, you know, for all those reasons, they're starting to have to open up to this. But actually, also, it comes back to this point I was talking about earlier about you're preparing for disasters like this. You can't do it in a sort of monolithic fashion. You can't prepare for a situation like this in a command and control fashion. What you need is people throughout the organization who are smart, self-motivated, you know, autonomous and responsible. And, you know, how do you get those people? You get them in part by putting trust in them and giving them the flexibility and the autonomy to operate as they see fit to deliver against the company's objectives. And so the companies that are going to respond best in this scenario and in all sorts of scenarios are the ones that have done that have pushed power to the edge of the organization. And you know, all of this is part of that. If you can trust the people at the edge, and if you've created the bounds and the training and the schemes to give you the reassurance that they're doing the right things, mm-hmm. then allowing them to work flexibly is just a no-brainer.
Yeah. And, you know, you bring up a great point there because, you know, I've been monitoring what's been going on LinkedIn, and especially with, you know, people having to work from home. And, you know, I've seen, you know, so many people saying, oh, you know, we're not allowed to work from home, or we've been told we have to come into work and stuff like this. And really at the heart of all that is trust. If you can trust your people to be able to do the job that you want them to do, surely you can let them work from home. Surely you can let them be with their family. Surely they can, you know, do the things that give them a sense of well-being. I mean, you know, it really is just down to trust, isn't it?
Yeah, I had a great chat with the CEO of HSBC, and this is in my next book, actually. We were talking about this, and he told me a story about you know, being asked to put in some policies for flexible working. Mm-hmm. And he said, and his response was, no, you do it. Like, you know, it was one of his reports. It's like, I don't have to centrally define the policy for your department and your department's department and your department's department, you know?
Right.
You take some responsibility, even better, pass the responsibility down the line and say, what works for your group of employees? What works for your group of people? Because the demands for the finance function are going to be different to the demands for HR, are going to be different to the demands for, you know, customer service. So do you know what? Find out what works for them so that you can maximize productivity. I mean, forget about even if you forget about the quality of life for your staff, what is going to maximize productivity? I guarantee it is not going to be everybody behaving the same, working the same hours in the same office 8 hours a day. There are a thousand better permutations.
That's fantastic. That's almost like, so you're sort of walking through a park to deliver a message to another office, and you see some fella fishing or something, and you say, well, where do you work? And you find out he works at the same company. He's just in a different department, and he doesn't have to be working right now, you know.
Sure. And you know what? It's going to happen, but people have to suck that up. You know, one of the other messages I find myself giving to companies is that you cannot have a monolithic corporate culture when you've got 50,000 people.
Right.
It's not possible. It's not even desirable.
No.
Because you know you've got people within those 50,000 people. Maybe there's 1,000 groups. And each of those 1,000 groups does something slightly different, is dealing with a slightly different customer or a different set of suppliers or a different set of challenges and problems. And trying to mold them all into one unified monolithic corporate culture where everybody sings Kumbaya from the same hymn sheet is just nonsense. It's a wasted effort. Sure, you need some shared core principles, but beyond that, you know, focus on what works.
The culture should almost be undefined. I mean, the shared culture is an undefined culture. That's kind of where you're driving this, isn't it?
Yeah, like I say, core principles are really important.
Yeah.
You know, what are we about? What is our mission? What are we trying to achieve here? But you know, you want to devolve as much autonomy as you can, be below that level, so that people can make the decisions they need to do and set the cultures they need to set in order to maximize their long-term productivity. And I would include in that the ability to maximize the happiness and reward for their staff.
Fantastic. That's a very insightful, Tom. Thank you very much for that. And I just want to change gears slightly now, if you don't mind, and circle back to your self-preservation article. In it, I picked out, you mentioned that you own an aging sports car.
I do.
Can I guess what it is?
You can guess.
I'm going to go British and I'm going to go with MG.
It's not, although I have got my eye on MG at the moment. Okay. And because my eldest daughter really wants us to do up a car.
Yeah,
it's an Alfa Romeo.
You know, that was going to be, I was going to go Italian, but never mind.
It's a little Alfa GTV, which I think, barring maybe the MX5, is probably the best value little car on the road these days.
Yeah, what fun.
And it's great fun. It's a thing of beauty. I've always liked them. And I don't really need a second car. There's like one occasion every couple of weeks where, you know, the two kids are going in different directions and we can't do it by public transport, where it gets a run out. And other than that, it just looks pretty on the driveway.
Beautiful, beautiful. Complete opposite to mine. I drive a sofa, I tend to go big with cars, but no, that's fantastic. So,
mine's particularly sharp and pointy because it's been had a few upgrades, shall we say?
Oh, fantastic! Well, we'll have to swap photographs of the vehicles. But talking of leisure time and stuff like that, I mean, what do you do when you're not being an applied futurist? Do you have a kind of hobbies and interests and stuff?
Yeah, well, obviously the kids consume some of that time. Do like a game of table tennis. Well, I'm currently 12-1 down against my wife for the last 3 days. She's absolutely thrashing me.
Is she qualified to do? I mean, is she a sort of a table tennis player?
No, she's just better than me.
Okay.
Do you know what, usually we're very evenly matched, but I've got off to a very bad start. And actually, I think it's mainly her. She's just playing really well. But then most of the time, I like to make stuff. So I'm actually talking to you from my workshop where I'm surrounded by, if I'm honest, lots of half-finished projects. Some finished projects.
Great.
As well. But I trained in mechatronic engineering originally. So I like to write a bit of code, do a bit of soldering, make some stuff. So I've got a 3D printer behind me.
Lovely, man. I've got a buddy like that as well. Does the same thing. It's just kind of with this sort of crazy inventoring workshop and stuff. It's fascinating. And I sort of tend to walk around and pick things up, and he's like, "Don't touch that! Don't touch that!"
I keep wanting to tidy my desk, and then coming to the conclusion that I'm actually happiest when there's at least, you know, three circuit boards, a bunch of wires, and a few electric motors sort of scattered across it. That's when I feel most at home, I think.
Well, you see, you're only trying to tidy it because you're trying to conform to somebody else's idea of what is tidy. I mean, you know, that's just your culture, right?
This is it, Keith. This is it. I've decided my culture is messy, messy, crazy inventor.
Fantastic. Well, listen, finally, I mean, with every guest who's good enough to spend time on the show, I'd like to sort of hand over the reins to you for a couple of minutes, and so you can tell everybody out there in agency land what you're up to, promote something, let us know. I mean, obviously, you've got your podcast, which I subscribe to, by the way. Just have at it and tell us what you're up to and how we can get hold of you if we need to, and away you go.
Well, TomCheeseRack.com is your source for all things me. And since I'm talking to your agency bosses, I would say that I do a lot of work with agencies. You know, a lot of you can split my work into what you might call the serious and the frivolous. The serious is, you know, companies ringing me up and saying, help. And the frivolous, and I say that with tongue in cheek, tends to be marketing campaigns.
Okay.
Where people want to talk about the future.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I say, good examples recently, this future pizza thing, which was to launch the Big Bang Fair down at the NEC in Birmingham. So a science, technology, engineering fair for kids. And, you know, the projects like that, I mean, people are just always fascinated by the future. So yeah, I ended up having a film crew coming over from Germany for this show that, as far as I can tell, in Germany is like a cross between The One Show and Tomorrow's World. Doing like a 20-minute segment on me making pizza in a pizzeria in Crazy Pedro's in Manchester.
You're a good guest.
Yeah, and then, you know, this future car project we've just done with Auto Trader. It's been, you know, I keep getting clippings in from my publicist, from, you know, like Kenya and from Malaysia. And
you were involved in that future car thing, because I we covered that in the Advertist as well. But so what was your involvement on that? Really?
Yeah, I wrote it. Yeah, yeah.
Fantastic.
That's a fairly typical project for me these days. As a company will come to me, and sometimes it's B2B. Mm-hmm. So I worked with HyperOptic recently on the future of broadband. And sometimes it's B2C, like, you know, this sort of stuff where I, you know, write the theme tune, sing the theme tune. I write the report, and then go and sit in a radio studio for a day to launch it and do the broadcast interviews as well. It's really good fun.
That's fantastic. And so yeah, you've got
website.
Okay, so it's tomcheesewright.com.
And yeah, go to the website, subscribe to the podcast, subscribe to the newsletter.
Fantastic. And you've got a book already out, and you've got another one in the pipeline, right?
That's right, yeah. So High Frequency Change is available now, and Future Proof Your Business. Official publication date is 30th of July, but yeah, watch this space, because
beautiful,
given how relevant and timely it feels, we may bring that forward slightly, certainly for the digital and audio editions if we can.
Well, as you've been a wonderful guest, Tom. I really appreciate it. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you, and I hope that we do get together to discuss the new book when it comes out. Hopefully, when all this viral chaos has subsided, and we'll be able to look back and say, "See, we told you this was going to happen," and then I could say that I'm a futurist too. But so anyway, I appreciate that, Tom. Thank you very much, and thank you for being on, and have a great day.
You too. Absolute pleasure, Keith.
Well, I'm so glad we got through that without me looking too stupid. Tom is so knowledgeable, and it's important for us to capture his lightning in this podcast-sized bottle. If you didn't catch it, he's just launched a book, which I advise you order on Amazon, and he's got another on the way, and as soon as this wretched virus leaves us all alone, he'll be doing the speaker circuit too. So check out his website at tomcheesewright.com and have a listen to his cast, because he's got a really varied bunch of interviews with some neat guests. He's also recorded a few bite-sized think pieces that might just give you a few ideas about what's coming around the corner and help you win that next forward-thinking client. I'd like to thank Tom Cheesewright for being such a wonderful guest, so much better than all the rest. My co-producer and wife Donna, our IT wizard and friend Matt Smith at Quijibo Design, and of course ivory tickler Peter Banks for the music. So we'll catch you next time around on the Fuel Podcast, when we'll be giving out more help and advice for creative agencies that have a vested interest in new business. And really, shouldn't that include you?